So let's we're going to discuss a few things. This is too loud. Both we're going to go back a little bit to try and understand, well, discuss a little bit more about the minimal coupling and some of the consequences we have with that. So let me illustrate a few things. We're going to try and get some, as I told you on, what was it, Tuesday, we're going to look, go back to a calculation we kind of already did, but analyze it in a different way, and then try and see how we can make contact with some geometrical understanding of what might transpire in a given spacetime. And then we're going to move on to try and get the first non-trivial solution for Einstein's equations. But let's start. Remember the minimal coupling. We said, well, if there is any coupling with any source, we're going to just kind of write it, if you want, in the terms of the action as its individual thing. We're not allowing, if you want, products of the Ricci scalar or the Riemann tensor with any of the RF fields that may describe these RF physics that we want to add. But let's just start with a very simple case. So suppose you had, let's go back to the geodesic equations. The equation, let's say it's a finely parameterized, at least at the get-go. We could have considered, rather than having a zero on the right-hand side, something, let me just say, suppose something of this form. So this would violate the principle of equivalence. So what we have here, so I know, so this is the acceleration of a curve that has tangent or coordinates given by xa. So this was our geodesic equation. And here I'm just drawing, suppose you could have conceived of this. So it's the grad, we're taking the covariant derivative of r. So with this, we can make sense in a covariant form. Some coupling here, the tangent to that curve, and of course, to make signs work out the right way, I want to contract this with some the tangent. So we could have considered this. And you could ask the question, well, would it, in the experiments on Earth, would we have any sense of these being perhaps a potential replacement for the geodesic equation? So let's just put some numbers. Yeah. Dxa, d lambda, yes. And then this d is contracted with that d. So we can just look at, and this is an exercise that it's always useful to kind of have in the back pocket, and every now and then remind yourself, just when you're doing calculations, where the scales or the scales or the dimensional scales in the problem make sense. So when we think of metric, so we're saying, well, if we compute distances, this is what we're doing. We're using the metric with small displacements on our manifold and compute distances this way. And we can have, as we said, positive, zero, or negative, depending where we're talking about space-like, null, or time-like. But then the notion of distance, or what is carrying the dimensions of distance, is sitting here in the d-axis. The metric has no unit. So the order dimensionally, and this is the notation we have, so the units or the length scales associated with the metric are L to the zero. So that doesn't measure anything. We said the x's are giving a sense of lengths, if you want. So this dx has length, but divided by d lambda has no length. So dx d lambda is also L zero for any coordinate that we choose. And then if the metric with index is down has no units, of course, the metric with the index up also has no units. So they're all L0, L to the zero. But the Christoffels have what? So we have metrics, and we have derivative of the metric, right? So this will give us the Christoffel length scale is L to the minus one. So if we come in here, this term comes with L to the zero. Sorry, one over L to the minus one, because dx, d lambda has no units, but we're dividing order with a 1 over lambda. Here, this has L to the 0, L to the 0. This one is the one that has L to the minus 1. Again, this one will give us L to the 0. And here, OK, we have the Riemann or anything related to the Riemann. Remember, R goes like second order of the metric. So this, we're just carrying. The only thing we're trying to capture here is the scaling with length. So then this one will go like 1 over L square. We have 1 over L square. We're taking a further derivative. So this goes like 1 over L cube. So the left-hand side at 1 over length scaling. And then this piece is 1 over L cube. That means that this coupling, if you want that it's violating the principle of equivalence, should scale like L square. So now we have, when we construct this, we have introduced some parameters. So where we said general relativity as such had no intrinsic scale. If we consider a theory that will give rise to this, now there is a scale that is coming into the game. So we can ask at what point or what distances would this alpha play a role? How deep is must our measurement be before we actually begin to feel the sensitivity of this? So you can say, well, in the absence of any R scale, the only scale we can think of is the Planck length, right? Which was 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. We can contrast these with the natural length scale for, say, experiments on Earth. So what, again, we said, what's the natural quantity we can have associated to the physical context where we would be working at? What's the natural length scale that we can have there? So well, on Earth, we have, and we're thinking of gravitational interactions, we have the acceleration, which scales like what? Meters over second square. So if I want to turn that acceleration that we're measuring, in local neighborhood here, 9.8 meters per second square, if we want to turn this to a scale, well, the other thing we can use is c, the speed of light, that goes like meters over seconds. And then that says that the scale that you can form with out of those two guys would be c over square over a. And this turns out to be 10 to the minus 18, 10 to the 18 centimeters.
And sorry, why would they pick, because c isn't really just, a meter over a second. It's not 1 meter per second. It's like 3 times.
No, right. So I'm just simply here. I have never put any number. I'm just wondering what's the scale. So c scales like m over meters per second is meter per second squared. And I'm asking, how can I combine these two numbers to get a length out of it? And then I would do c squared over a. But there is where you absolutely put the right magnitude for c, the right magnitude for a. Here I didn't put 9.8 meters per second squared.
Oh, so and 10 to the 18 centimeters is from 3 times 10 to the 8.
Square divided by 9.8 meters. And once you do that, that's where you get 10 to the 18 centimeters. So then you can compute. You can calculate what's the standard length scale for experiments on Earth that will kind of probe gravitational interactions for particles that are falling in, say, a weakly curved space time. And the Planck length. We're way off what would be the natural scale where you would say, maybe this is where we'll be seeing differences. So, of course, you can consider many more arguments, much more nuanced arguments, and you can say, well, these kind of exercise also gets us in trouble for the cosmological constant. But if you do a similar analysis for what the vacuum contribution for an effective cosmological constant would be, you end up with a number that is completely insane with respect to what you can measure. So it might not be that this is the right way of approaching, but it's something you would like to kind of have an understanding to at least say, well, do I hope to be close enough or very far from probing something that will be kind of violating the equivalence principle in the most naive calculation you can think of.
Sorry, can you remind me again of what the rationale was behind the right-hand side of the above equation?
We just said, suppose there is some coupling. So we said particles will follow geodesics, so they are free-falling in the curved space-time. Bless you. But here we're saying, well, let's entertain some other theory that has that be such that it violates that principle. Okay, so what are the things we can couple it to? Naturally, if we don't call for any AR interactions with AR physics, is, well, let's couple it with the curvature. So we can make many things out of the curvature. We can make many terms here. Let's just consider the simplest possible one. We take the Ricci scalar or anything related to the Ricci. And we're saying, well, this is a geodesic equation. Well, let's imagine we couple this way with the first derivative of that curvature times R, and then a coupling. And then you go, of course, you could have just put R. I wouldn't have needed to put this one. Then the scaling would have been different. Now it's not 1 over L cubed, it's 1 over L squared. This one would be L, so we maybe have a better chance. But then it's up to you what you're considering to violate the right-hand side. This is just to motivate, well, what could you entertain might change the equation. So here and there. No, we're saying suppose you're going to consider a theory or a framework where you're going to violate a theory. So GR was built with the assumption that we're going to respect that principle. But suppose you're now going to consider something else where you're going to allow a violation to take place. So that might be something you want to consider. You could try and say, can I build a theory where that is a true acceleration of a particle in the gravitational field?
That Lin scale is not associated with GR. It's associated with the theory which supposes.
So it's a length scale, yeah, or something. And so the only natural scale that you might think of is the Planck length. So it's natural to expect that if generativity is going to be broken, it would be at this scale. With some caveats, but let's say it's this scale. Now you say, well, if I'm going to be doing experiments on Earth, what is the natural scale that I'm accessing? This is this one. So if you're going to expect, if your natural expectation is the violation with respect to GR happens here, you're saying, oh, I'm way off. So either I build up a very strange theory here, with like, again, so we just said, notice it's alpha, this thing goes like L squared. So this relative strength of where we have to go, if this is where we expect any violation to take place, from where we are, is the square of this, the ratio of these two. So we're 10 to 100 away from where we would expect a violation. However, if we then think of a theory that doesn't have these, but have something like that, well, we're only 10 to the 50 times away. And of course, you could consider other combinations, but then you're, well, you have to expect or motivate that somehow. But the caveat of all this is, well, again, as I said, the array, people that will point to the need for a cosmological constant or the need for dark matter are already saying, well, we have plenty of evidence that generativity is incorrect. We need to change it. I'll get to one example in a second. You had a question?
Yes. So we're saying that the alpha thing here, the alpha coupling, which goes like L squared, is it's fair to assume that L is the Planck length, is what you're saying?
That would be the most kind of conservative way. So we know here we're gonna have to face the quantum nature of everything. So in particular, our classical theory will be breaking down at this scale.
But so GR has most general coordinate transformation symmetries. It's invariant under diffeomorphisms. Morphisms.
Yes.
If you introduce such a length scale,
you're also going to break that. Yeah, you.
On large distances, like on this scale, for example, then it has to reappear somehow. And
is that
a possible thing? Like, have people done that? Or
have people done that? I mean, in some sense, I would say all quantum gravity efforts have that built in. So the space-time is discrete at very small scales. And then when you kind of zoom out, you see a continuum. And there, as you recover that diffeomorphism invariant. But yeah, so they all, in fact, this is one of the most delicate aspects of trying to go for a quantum theory of gravity, that is built in from the get-go, or that problem is faced from the get-go. I mean, if you don't have an answer to that question, you're not even in the game. So just for illustration, in no way whatsoever do I say this is the best alternative theory you can consider. It's just an illustration of things that we have discussed and things that you may consider doing. So suppose there's a large family of theories called scalar tensor theories. Which raise their head primarily or kind of were motivated strongly from cosmological considerations, going after trying to have an explanation for the cosmological constant, naturally somehow interfacing, at least at face value, with ideas on inflation. And it's to consider that your theory is not general relativity. It's something that looks like general relativity, but it's a funny coupling with an extra field, with an extra scalar field. So again, I'm not going to go in details because it's not at the core of this course. I'm just illustrating some of the things given that the context of what we've been discussing. So suppose now, so we're going to start from the action. So this is your action for the scalar tensor theory. We'll go like, and again, I'm being sloppy. I'm not going to be putting here 1/16 pi g, whatever. We're just putting the main ingredients. So suppose you consider the following. Here is R, right as we had before, before x. And we're going to stick in here some function yet to be determined or yet to be prescribed, and another scalar field. So now our main fields are the gravitational field plus one scalar field. And again, you motivate that because of many reasons, depending on where you're coming from. Well, we know of one scalar field in nature that is key, that's a Higgs boson. We know that if you want to build or you believe on the inflationary paradigm, there is a scalar field there that gets the job done. So it's natural to think, well, let's do this. And if you are going to add an extra degree of freedom to the theory, or if you're going to add extra degrees of freedom to your theory, adding one is the first step. So this would be a way to do that. So you can go through the machinery of saying, what are the equations of motion that this sort of theory will produce? So we do the same thing. If we want to find the evolution of the degree of freedom associated with, or metric degree of freedom. So these are our degrees of freedom. We have, again, a manifold. And then in that manifold, we have g and phi. You vary with respect to g to obtain the equation of motion that the metric, the g, will have to satisfy. And then we know what we're going to pick. So we're going to pick something here. We're going to pick something there. We have two terms, the g and the r. We know that we vary r. We think we know when we vary r, that doesn't contribute. But I'll tell you that's not quite the case. And this f comes along for a ride until you hit that issue. So once we vary these with respect to the metric, what do we pick? Well, we pick terms like so. We have. Because we're varying with respect to the metric, I is considered a constant. So we have something that gives us the Einstein equation, which we know where we picked it from. We picked it from the case when we vary the determinant, and when we vary the metric here, that is creating the Ricci scalar for us. So we have something that goes like so. But then we had, and I'm going to just be symbolic here, we had things that were grad and grads, and I'm going to put delta g here. So here's where we have the covariant derivative of the variation of the Christoffels, right? Remember the difference of the Christoffels. And we argue that if we manipulate things the right way, this just ended up being the divergence of a vector, which was made out of Christoffels derived, or the derivative of the Christoffel. And then we threw it away, assuming that boundaries did not contribute. But now we can't, because there is this thing sitting here. So it's It's not proportional to delta G. So what we have to do is do iteration by parts. For this term, SU, we already have this piece. Let me write it this way, F phi GAB. This one has the structure we want, but these ones here do not. So we have to do so how do we proceed here? Well, we do iteration by parts. We write this as the gradient of the whole thing, and that we can throw away with the same assumptions that far out there is no variations of our main fields. Yeah. We have one, but then the Christoffel. Right, so I'm just saying, reminding you there is the Christoffel had in it. And we said we didn't have to worry. Remember, we said, well, that one is a very messy thing. We could consider varying with respect to the metric, but it was an easier thing to do first. It was to then consider the variation with respect to just the Christoffels. So we had here.
Wanted to change the
covariant
derivative
with delta? So we're not interchanging the covariant derivative with the delta. We want to get this delta alone. So that's what we do iteration by parts.
Delta gamma, and gamma is equal to something g, and then you're exchanging the delta with the covariant derivative because you had derivative of g inside.
We have to be careful. We can look at that calculation in detail, but so what we did before was to say, when we had to do the delta of the Riemann, we have GAB, right? We said, treating this thing, we could go and then remember that this R was written in terms of Christoffels and consider the variation of the Christoffel to write it in terms of delta G. And we said, let's stop short here because we knew, or I knew, that we could throw away that term or see that that term would not contribute just by considering this thing, because we would write it in terms of the divergence of a vector that had the delta gamma. Now we don't have that luxury because we are trying to pull out the delta gamma out. And so we have to bite the bullet and then write this further step, which is much more complicated. And then once you land to that, where again, I promise this is really messy, but we're not. For the purpose of what we're doing here, is that's not relevant. We're saying, well, we have something here, and we need to clean it up. We want to pick the delta G out of it. So what we do is we do iteration by parts. So this we write as the grad of all these minus the right terms. And then we do it again. But those right terms that come in here end up then being written at something that goes square root of minus g of things and involves now second derivatives of this f, because we took two derivatives. And what I'm just going to tell you as a result, you end up with an equation of motion that if you want to say, well, I'm going to write the equations in as close a shape as we had before, well, we have the GAB from here, and then we have these R states. So the equation of motion now will turn into 1 over F. Why? If we have minor sources, the minor sources are still there. But then we have further things that are coming from the scalar field. This is standard stress energy tensor of the scalar field that we wrote the other day. Again, I'm not that worried about these things, but I'm just what I want to point out is that you're going to pick up things like this. Bless you. So now these terms are new. They came from the fact that we had this coupling, and this had to do with, remember, we said, okay, what do we mean by minimally coupled? Is that any time we get a new degree of freedom, we don't consider products of the Riemann tensor, our main kind of curvature tensor, and these degrees of freedom. If they are there, they're added simply by the volume element or sticking extra terms additional terms to the action. And the equation, if you bar it now with respect to phi, the equation of motion of phi, again, is something where you have the box of phi. Remember, if we added these to the right-hand side minimally, we just had a box equation for phi, if we assume there was no potential. But this one will give us a much more complicated expression, which in particular has, as the right-hand side, kind of the functional derivative, or let me just put it this way, df d phi. I'll write this way, times r. So now this field that our principle of equivalence would have said, if we choose a small enough region, would have evolved in exactly the same way as before, now it's not. As in flat space time, now it's not. We find out that the derivative operator or the equation of motion determined that the dynamics of that extra degree of freedom is now coupled. We have an r times the f prime, where f is this, the derivative of f with respect to phi. So this is completely new. Of course, if you're in flat space-time, that goes away. But if we have any small curvature, this is showing up.
Sorry, Chris.
Yes.
What does that mean physically in the sense of, for example, we motivated the equivalence principle by saying the gravitational mass and the inertial mass are equal, and therefore that leads us to think of it this way. If we have terms like this that show up even locally that talk about the curvature of the space,
right? Basically, it means that now the object, this extra degree of freedom, is aware of the curvature of space-time, and it changes depending on how the curvature is. So if you have if you make up an atom out of this, the atom in isolation will behave very different from an atom. So an atom sitting in the moon and an atom sitting on Earth will behave in a significant or quote unquote in enough different way that sufficiently accurate experiments might be able to tell them apart. So you could be kind of the observer in the elevator, and I put you on the surface of the moon or on the surface of the Earth, and you will tell me, I know where I am by a sufficiently sensitive measurement. The reason, just for context, the reason people entertain this theory, as I said, is that notice what you have. You have GAB equal to something. And if this field happens to be sufficiently well behaved, then you can make this object or this extra piece behave or contribute like as if it were a cosmological constant for the right combination. So this theory is built up by the following assumption, something I didn't say. You add one extra degree of freedom, that's one, and you demand that the equation of motion are of second order type. If that's your requirement, then you end up with something like this. And faculty from UW many years ago, his name is Horndensky, wrote the most general family of theories under that assumption. You end up with a very complicated theory. This is one of the simplest ones, which is called the scalar tensor theories. But under that assumption, you end up with a family that is quite large, but it's the most general theory that you can write under those assumptions. A metric tensor, one scalar degree of freedom, and that the equations of motion are at most second order. Any questions? Okay. Yeah.
What's the reason
for this assumption?
Yeah.
Oh. The second derivative?
Yeah.
Good question. For that, you need to take the next advanced relativity course. I can tell you now, but if you have this theory, or you have this theory, if you have this equation, right, that's a wave equation in 1D. Everything is nice about that equation. And then you say, I'm going to add this piece. And if you want, you can add whatever number here that you want that is as arbitrary small. I can guarantee that this problem will not have a global solution. It's going to blow up in your face. The terminology is called mathematically ill-posed. any problem governed by this equation is mathematically ill-posed. Of course, that doesn't deter physicists. We find ways of biting the bullet, closing your eyes, and moving forward. So there are equations where this shows up, but it's very delicate. I mean, it's very delicate to make sense of things. So just I'll give you one example. If you remember do you guys remember the Abraham-Lorentz force law? Okay, that's enough. So take a particle that is charged, make it then fall through a region of space-time that has an electromagnetic field. So you know that particle will couple and will be accelerated. But the particle that is accelerated also radiates. If it radiates, now there is a back reaction on its trajectory. So the equation of the motion in that case will be the acceleration of the particle is equal to the force, I mean Q times E. But because of the radiation, then you end up with another piece that is like so. So there is a piece in here that is the one that will correct the trajectory by the self force that the particle is producing in itself and the radiation that is coming out. And this equation is highly non-trivial to solve because of the same problem. And then there are ways of dealing with that are well understood, that work well in the case of ODE, but when you go into PDE, all bets are off. In fact, if you go and talk to your mathematician friend, they will look at you and say, are you nuts? Why are you working with this? But as I said, that doesn't deter physicists. Yes?
For the case of matter, we wanted to measure action for the matter in the universe. I understand that minimal coupling can be a good approximation or any first good first guess because you're adding matter in the geometry. But for this case of a scalar field, it's just I don't really see how this minimal coupling can model the response between geometry and this underlying field, like a field like Higgs or inflaton that's going to exist in entire universe. How minimal coupling, how do you motivate minimal coupling even in these cases? Because Higgs is completely
pervasive,
different from right?
Well, I mean,
we need another kind of response, just
so
generally.
I mean, so it is minimally coupled. It doesn't mean that it's not affecting the dynamic, right? So, in this case, so in the GR case of this one, would have given you GAB is TAB of the scalar field, which will have grad A of phi, grad B of phi. Oops, minus 1/2 GAB. Grad A, grad C, phi square. So the scalar field is affecting the metric, is changing the curvature of the space-time.
The shape of response is exactly like the matter, because you're assuming a minimally coupled for both of them. But also it's going to give mass to all the matter that we have in the universe, so it should be coupled to the.
Yeah, so it's clear. It will be coupling to, so I would have, let's say if I have, I don't know. It's that baryons there. So okay, you would have something here that might have the coupling of this Higgs with the rest of your matter. There will be couplings this way. And their effect will be felt by your geometry. And of course, then the equation of motion of the scalar field and whatever other equations for the matter, like big T equal to zero. This might be coupled, so you're fine there. So you could, I think what you were asking is, well, we know the Higgs is affecting and, or in the right regime, was affecting all the other particles. Well, that would be here. And their role with respect to the geometry of the curvature of the space-time can still be accounted for the minimally coupled. So you could say this is your simplest assumption, and you run with it until you see a problem. And if you don't see a problem, then that's perfectly fine. You have to, in physics, you have to complicate your life as much as you need, but not more, until nature tells you otherwise. All right, so let's go back to something we discussed before, but we're going to give it a twist and see it slightly from a different angle. So suppose, again, so this one we had, and now I'm going to change names. So this is, so that you know, this contain is an appendix F of Carol. So let's just say that. So suppose you have a congruence of geodesics, which will have tangent vector UA. And we imagine that we have the orthogonal vector, how do we call it, VA, associated to it. And we describe the relative acceleration of this vector as we move about the geodesic. We're going to go back to it. We're going to use part of the calculation. We're going to be asking something a bit more general. And for the purpose of what we're going to do, we're going to add a few other concepts. So associated to the vector UA, which we're saying is geodesic, so this is true. That's one. We can always construct something we're going to call a projector. So it's a projector orthogonal to U. So let me define it first, and then we can check that it satisfies the properties. Let me call it H, the projector HAB. It's going to be GAB plus a reminder, our convention is this. This is a time-like geodesic. So you can check that this H indeed takes any vector that happens to go be along U and set it to zero. So if I multiply this by UB to the right, and when UB hits UB, it gives you minus one. That creates a minus UA for me. And when UB hits GAB, that creates some UA for me. So then that zeroes out. So this says that it you take. So let's do this. This is GAB UB plus UA UB UB. So that's zero. And you're going to see projectors like this again and again once you do formal calculation, especially when in the advanced in the strong gravity course, when you're trying to find kind of a geometrodynamics approach to Einstein's equations, where you say, well, I want to give my state of the field at some given time, and I want to know what happens towards the future. These projectors will come in very handy to come out with something that's covariant and split it in a form that is amenable to this thinking of time flowing some way. And that time will be associated with some particular vector that is time-like. So far so good. So let me define the following two tensor. So I'm going to call it BAB. Just grad A, UB. So out of the blue for a moment, let's define this. Let's look at the properties. So this is true. And this is true. Who wants to tell me why? Let's say, why the first one?
Geodesic.
Good. Why the second?
Using the first, you can put it inside.
Say again?
Ruby is minus one.
Exactly. So this is because of our vector is geodesic, and this is it's normalized. So here is this one is UA grad A UB, remember, it doesn't matter for a covariant index where it's up or down. We can always hit it with a metric. The metric comes clean inside the covariant derivative and brings it up if I want. So then this is the same as that one. And the R one is UB grad A of UB, which is, I can put it inside. And this will be grad A UB UB divided by 2. But U is normalized, so that's the grad of a constant, and that's 0. Okay, why did we introduce that? We introduced because we're interested in the following. What does this quantity do? So suppose we want to say, how does this tensor change along our congruence? And this tensor is nothing but the tensor we constructed when we were looking at the acceleration, the relative acceleration. So it's grad of u, if I were to hit it with v, remember, we ask for u and v to commute. And this told us that ua and a of bb was equal to, oops, ea grad a of ub. So this thing appeared there. And we use it explicitly when we computed our geodesic equation. Now we're just trying to see what are the properties of this guy. So let's just go through the motion. So this will be uc grad c of grad a ub. Let me just change the notation. Grad b, a and b, a stands for the index of u and b for the grade. Covariant derivative. So put this way. Yeah, so that I follow the same notation that the book has. I want this one. Okay, so here we're going to use our commutator. So I want to write this in the opposite way, which will pull out a Riemann. And we're taking the covariant derivative, the commutator of a covector that will have a plus sign. Covariant derivative vector had a minus sign. This is uc grad b c ua plus rd c ea c ud. And I forgot here, so if, yes, so that is good. And so I'm going to rewrite this as pulling the derivative out once more. And this is the same trick we did last time. And then, because I pull out the derivative over the full thing, I have to still subtract the pieces here. So this will be minus grad b u c grad b u a.
Is it both going to be the subscript b?
Say again. Ah, no, this is, what did I do wrong? Grad b, this is c. Pull out this in. Yes, this is C. Sorry, I did something wrong here. So let me just, so this is C. grad C UA, and this grad B UC.
Shouldn't there be one more term?
One more term?
With the, yeah.
So I had it here. I pull it out. That's that one. And I have to subtract when grad only acts here. So this minus that gives me that. But this one again, U is geodesic, so that one is zero. This one are what we define by B. So this is minus B, BC, BC, B, A, sorry. Oh, C, B, B, A, C, plus R, D, C, B, A. Okay, so at this point we haven't done much and we haven't used our projector. So I introduced this for something. So let me use it now. Even any vector, and this we already did before with the Riemann, but now let's do it again. We want to write this BA, B in the convenient set of quantities. So let me first introduce a few. Let me define theta, which is BAB contracted or traced by HAB. So let's see what this thing is using our definition. Okay, this would have been grad B of UA, HAB is what? GAB plus UA UB. When this one acts here, that's the divergence of that vector, right? And when this one acts here, I get a zero. Because of whichever choice you want, either because it's geodesics or it's normalized, this theta is now then the divergence of that vector. So if my congruence, so if I have a kind of a circle and this congruence is doing this, this theta is measuring that. It's just saying this kind of trajectory of this congruence of rays or tangents associated to the congruence is just either expanding if it is positive or is converging if it is negative. So that measures something convenient for us. Let's introduce another one. Sigma AB, which we're going to define to be BAB symmetrized minus 1/3 theta HAB. So what are we doing here? We're constructing a tensor, a two-tensor, out of the symmetric part of our BAB, and we're subtracting out of it the expansion. Notice that 3 is because the sub-manifold that is defined, that is orthogonal to our U, so we're in 4 dimensions, and if we're now, say, we have this vector here, and then this H projects orthogonal to it, our space is 3 dimensions. So the orthogonal to the tangent to the vector is 3 dimensions. This is why this 3 is. And in fact, you can check that the trace of this guy gives you 3, doesn't give you 4. So GAB is equal to 4, but HAB is equal to 3. This is why this 3 is there. So what this is measuring, if you want, is also how this thing is expanding in some ways, but subtracting the expansion, the mean expansion. So this is called the shear tensor. So if this thing, as it expands, kind of gets to be kind of an ellipsoid or change shape from a circle, this is what this thing is giving. So it's, I'm saying, it's saying the relative motion of two geodesics that are by each other. And the other object we're going to define is what we're left here. We have left out, which is the anti-symmetric part of BAB. So, and this is called the twist. So if this thing, as this geodesic, as it's coming out, expanding and contracting, having some relative kind of motion in between two of them, and in addition, kind of twists, this is what this thing is measuring. And out of these three quantities, we can just re-express that guy. Our BAB will simply be given by, yes. Say again. Yes. That's right. This is why.
I didn't get the third one.
Oh, it's the anti-symmetric part. So we're still, it's incomplete. So the twist is in addition to, like, one is this, the other one is this, and then the twist is where they're doing that, where this thing is kind of twisting in addition to the shear and expansion. So this, let's see. So if I have this cube, right? Let's imagine that we forget about the divergence. So shear is this one moving this way, this thing moving this way, and that one moving that way. That's shear. And then the twist is in addition, this thing might be just turning or just as you go along where you're doing this. Right? And so we can now use, yes.
It's kind of hard for me to picture from the BAB and the HAB that you then get the twist and shear.
So if you, I mean, this is what you're saying is your computer deformation that is completely symmetric, but subtract from it just the mean expansion.
Okay.
So that's what it's doing. So this one, this is the mean expansion, and the difference of that symmetric vector with that, which is also. So this, if this kind of, if you start with an null ray here, so a spherical thing goes into this R spherical thing, that's just the expansion, it just expanded. So you're trying to say, well, if it, in addition to that, it might have done this. So you're saying measure that by computing the expansion, subtracting that from this tensor, the symmetric part, that will tell you where you're doing, also doing this. And then the anti-symmetric part is where it's twisting in addition to that, is carried out in here. And this is, of course, doesn't have any of these components because it's anti-symmetric. I'll try and find an animation of this and maybe bring it next week.
Why are the wavy lines shear?
Say again?
You drew the picture of wavy lines and that's shear. Why is that shear? That shear was when you kind of go like
Yeah, so that's, I mean, I'm not a good drawer, so I imagine that these things went a little bit like that, so as to then give you this deformation. Again, so let me look for an animation, because I'm an awful drawer, and I think I'm not helping by trying to draw. I think that the animation would be better.
Would it be possible to, like, write out the components of this tensor so we could kind of see, like, you know, like, it's the, you know, like, X, Y components of this year.
Yeah, we could do that.
Okay.
We can do it. I'll try and do that for Monday.
I mean, could you just go through the meaning of BAB, HAB, and theta just for me to, just for my sake?
Yeah, so this is just a divergence of the tangent. Yeah. So if this thing just stay like so, then you would have zero divergence.
Yeah, if
positive is if it contracts negative. And that's what this thing is measuring. Now this thing is saying, take me any R variation that doesn't involve twisting, subtract what I just called divergence, and I'm, that's the shear. And it will tell you the relative. Say again?
Why is it multiplied by that tension? Why not something else? Why not something else?
Oh, because these are all projects. Good. Excellent question. All these things are orthogonal to, so BAB. Great. Thanks for asking that. BAB was completely orthogonal to you. So we could put G's if you want, but it will not, it will do nothing, the G's, because of this. Right? Any, or because, yes, imagine the definition of the H. Right? So anytime with heat, so, or think of it this way, the G, I can write it as H minus the U's. Right? If I heat with the G's, because BAB is purely orthogonal to you, whether I have this or not doesn't matter.
Okay, but
if this is a tensor, that tensor BAB is defined on this submanifold that is orthogonal to the U. So what we're doing is computing things here. How these things deform as you go to the next slice, as you follow U. So if I have, if I had that circle, and then this circle again, either expanded or contracted, twisted or deformed, that's what these things are measuring on one slice to the next one.
I still don't get it.
So what were the questions? Let's go back to the questions. So first is what one of the questions was why.
Why is GAB using HAB and you said.
So sigma is a tensor that by so B, by definition, only lives in the submanifold. So it only, if you want, only knows about H from that point of view, or things that are projected onto that. And so then I could have put other things, but this thing is only lives there. So it's something, it's an object that is lives in the submanifold. So I'm just computing things with respect to that it's natural submanifold. And I want to get take out of these, out of the symmetric part of these, things that are kind of in senses acting in the same way. Effectively in any direction on that manifold, then that's that piece. And I'm subtracting that piece from this, and that's what I'm calling the shear. That's a relative deformation. And then any relative rotation, that's I'm putting in the twist.
What is the meaning of BAB?
AB?
BAB.
BAB is this one. So this is going to be a tensor.
The expansion from that gives shear.
So this is that tells us about any possible variation of the vector u. And we were using it before to measure the failure of the vector v we parallel transported along u. And now what we're saying is that failure, we're going to measure it with respect to some particular things that we can give geometrical meaning. Before it was just an acceleration. Now we're saying, let's interpret what this thing is. And the reason is because once we go in here, this decomposition will be particularly useful.
But what is symmetric
part? What's the symmetric part?
Why the symmetric part?
We still are keeping something in the anti-symmetric part. So this geometrically, the understanding, one is the twist, how you're twisting this congruence, and the other one is kind of, one is you're saying, any deformation, I can do something that is just this, something that is like that, and something that is a twist. So you're just trying to just kind of, the bookkeeping is, you're doing it that way. You're separating in respect to three things that you can geometrically understand.
Why is theta different from the determinant of the metric?
Theta different from the determinant of the metric?
Which also measures how the volume of the space.
But here we're saying, so. One thing, so here, in some sense, we're decoupling ourselves from the metric. We could have any metric whatsoever, and that's going to be interesting. We have to make some comments of that. Anyways, now we have some geodesics on that spacetime, and we're asking how are the geodesics behaving. Because there is a relation with the metric, and that would be telling us where these things are going to converge, expand, or whatever, depending on the behavior. So I can start with geodesics that are pointed this way, but if the curvature takes me that way, But that's what we're trying to ask. Can that happen?
Cool. Seeing the divergence from the grad BUV, we said theta equals grad BUV.
Yes, here.
If we just use the formula that we derived last time, which is 1 over the square root of the third.
Oh, sure. You can connect with that. But it also will tell it depends on the metric and your choice of curves. So there's it's both information are in there.
My question, I guess, is why does it depend on the choice of the curves? Because the curves are chosen by the metric. So.
I could choose, take let's take this here. And I can choose geodesics at initially, or let's take a plane, just for the sake of the argument. I mean, it's easier if we think of flat space-time. Any straight line is a geodesic, right? So I can choose this my space-time, this geodesic and that geodesic, or this geodesic and that geodesic. This one will have associated to it a negative divergence, and this will have an associated to it a positive divergence. So our choice of congruence would be delicate in what we choose, how we understand. And no, great question. So using that, these things we can write PAB in the following way. 1/3 theta HAB plus sigma AB plus omega AB. We're just simply decomposing that that tensor, 0-2 tensor, in between these three things that are geometrical. The next thing I'm going to do, and I'm going to leave part of it as an exercise, is use this one in here and trace it with GAB. When you do that, you will arrive at the following. D theta d tau, let's imagine that u was parameterized with tau. Trace the whole thing. And as I said, related to your question, we could say, well, and you could go back, hold on, why g and not h? Well, there is no difference between g and h here. But it will be a difference over there. And I'm trying to make up the Ricci tensor out of it. And so what you find out is that this tells you d theta d tau is -1/3 theta square minus
index of the which tensor, Riemann tensor should be A and B.
It doesn't matter. I mean, it's all contracted. I can put A and B.
First,
if you prefer this one.
No. I mean, the
DC. Yes. So this would be. No, C.
A should be operating. I mean, A should be lower, but.
Sorry. Well, I'm not understanding what index do you mean?
I mean, A and D should be exchanged.
Oh, you mean this one?
No, A and D. D.
A and D. Why did you say that? So I have D is contracted, C is contracted. I have B and A free. A and B, and then. This is the Riemann tensor, so there is a symmetry. I can flip A and B if you want. I can also put A and B. Is that what is bothering you?
Like the definition of a Riemann tensor. I think the second index is for contraction with the vector, and the first index for.
Let me see. No, I think I'm. But then you can use all the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. I think it's the same.
But the previous one says that if you contract with GAB, which is a symmetric tensor, then since there's an AB, you know, anti-symmetric, so it should be zero.
But this is not, this located this way, they are not anti-symmetric.
That, yeah, maybe that's true.
Yeah, you're right. When it was here, that was wrong. Yeah. Thank you. So now, but we're right. So this is what we wanted to get to. So nowhere here, up to that point, had we used Einstein's equation. And we have an equation that says the rate of change of this expansion is given by this term that is negative definite. Then you have this term, and okay, this gives me an opportunity to also stress something. Notice that, and I'll use this as an example, when we dot the u and the u, if this time-like, okay, it gives us minus one. If it is null, it gives us zero. If it is space-like, it gives us positive one. Let's say if we have normalized. So when we contract tensors or vectors fully contracted, we don't know what the sign of that object is going to be because we have contributions that could be negative and positive given the signature of the metric we're using. This is a fact of using a pseudo-Riemannian manifold. However, if we have an object, so having chosen a signature this way, we have an object that is purely space-like, then we're living in this sector. And therefore, square of tensors that are purely spatial, that we know the signs of. Right? There's nothing that will come in and give us a contribution with the opposite sign. So that was one of the things, or one of the reasons why we stress the tensor B is purely spatial. So it has both legs living on the spatial slice that is orthogonal to U. Is that clear? Yes.
Sorry, just going back a little bit. I know you said it before, but can you say again where we got the d theta over d tau? Is that from the trace?
Oh, this one, we did this. So this is the time derivative. We want the rate of change along u of b. Once I trace it, now this is a covariant. It's a covariant derivative, and this is another reason why we trace it with g, not with h. This comes in here and gives me a scalar, right? And the covariant derivative of any scalar is the same as the standard derivative. And the standard derivative along u is a rate of change along with respect to the parameter that parameterizes the curve. So this is d theta d tau. So now we have the first term is clearly negative definite. The second and third are also negative definite for the reasons I just mentioned. We're doing something, there's a contraction purely on the spatial part of the metric, or if you want, it's on space like hypersurface, which then has a definite signature that allows us to guarantee that this is going to be negative. So that's negative, negative, negative. Then we have this one, and I said we have yet to use Einstein's equation. So now we can use Einstein's equations here. And this will be the same as TAB up to the 8 pi. Remember, and G and those things are 1 unless we need to discuss them in a particular way. Minus, just make sure, plus 1/2 T. The reason I'm bringing this up is we up to here, this equation is telling us the rate of change of the divergence is negative, negative, negative. We don't know about this thing. This thing through Einstein's equation is this. So now we're talking about things that we know better. So when this is the stress energy tensor contracted with a time-like vector. So this is, by definition, but we're going to discuss more next week. Is the energy density measured by an observer that is going with this u. So you're an observer, your tangent is u, is your vector. This is what you would say, oh, this is raw.
What does the 1/2 t come from?
Remember, the Einstein equations was GAB equal TAB or RAB TAB minus 1/2 GAB t.
Shouldn't be R?
No. So this is here. Great question. So this is that. But remember, we can trace this one, and these links are with T. So then I can throw this one to the right-hand side, and then use that expression, and we arrive here. And so this one is rho. Now this is a trace of the stationary tensor, which is rho and pressure. The pressure comes in. And here is something we'll discuss a little bit and more in the advanced courses, that under some conditions, and this come under the rho terminology of energy conditions, you can guarantee that this thing is greater than or equal to zero, which then means this thing is negative. So any matter contribution or energetic contribution that we know of satisfies this. And so there is something called the non-energy condition, the strong energy condition, the weak energy conditions. So we're not, at this moment, we're not making any a strong point to try and distinguish this. I'm just saying for regular matter, this is true. So we have an equation that says this rate of change of the congruence, the divergence of the congruence, is negative definite, which then tells us, without having solved a single equation, we don't know what the metric is a solution of. We know that that these things will make the congruence begin to converge or converge.
What is the trace of T?
What is it true?
Why is the trace not negative?
We're going to discuss that. Because if you want, there's a contribution of the density and pressure, but the pressures are subleading typically. And so by and large, every case that we know of that we have control on has this. But then there are other contributions. So let me just wait 1 minute before I say what I would say. So this is telling us another thing, is that gravity is attractive. We don't have a contribution here that would push things in the opposite direction. So again, we are able to get that kind of purely out of geometry and just one little piece here. Of course, one could think of Riemann tensors, Ricci tensors associated to very weird manifolds endowed with a metric that we pull out of the blue sky, where this could have completely the wrong sign. This could have a very different sign. But we're saying if that Ricci is a solution of Einstein's equation, this is how we link with sources, and that guarantees that this thing will still be converged. What else? Yes.
Outside of the RAB terms, which by energy conditions you said are negative, why is it that even though those things don't depend on the metric, the theta, the sigmas, and they don't depend on the stress tensor, they're still negative?
These things?
Yeah.
These are negative definite because these are square of quantities that in a manifold that has a unique overview that has consistent positive signs. So the good thing is that we don't even need to know what these things are doing. This is just telling us whatever they do, this thing will be positive, that thing will be positive. As a result, this is negative definite.
And a flat space, for example,
yeah,
where the Ricci tensor vanishes,
yeah,
those terms would still be there.
Yeah. Well,
what does that mean?
It'll be there. Yeah, depending on congruence. This will tell you that the congruence, if you start with something, then we want to keep coming in. But in flat space time, will depend on what your congruence is. So if you have this thing, what this might evaluate is all to zero. So they will just continue expanding at the same rate. That's what would happen in flat space time. And now you can say, well, I'll throw it a little bit of source, and then these things will turn around. So this is where you truly know, this is where gravity is playing a role. So gravity will make things attract.
I didn't understand how does it expand in flat universe if flat RAB would be zero and the other terms that are negative?
No, so let's imagine that, well, they are negative, they are non-positive definite. So it could be, they are less or equal to zero. So in flat space time, this whole thing will evaluate to zero. And then I'm saying, suppose you throw in a little bit of a source, this would then make them converge.
What will happen if we have cosmological constant?
Okay, so then this will now add here a lambda GAB, and depending on the sign of the cosmological constant, you'll have one of the R1. And anti de Sitter is very, because it has a negative cosmological constant, you're going to have things kind of converge even without an REB. And de Sitter would have things expand even without an REB. Is that clear? So I want to stress, we have yet to solve Einstein's equations, and we are able, and we're already getting this information. And in fact, something I should also make sure I mention is that you can find out of this equation, just because now we have proven that d theta d tau, let's say plus 1/3 theta squared less or equal to 0, you can just out of this equation, you can say, well, suppose you have initially some convergence. So I start with a condition where this thing is begins to converge. You can use that equation to show that in finite time, these two things will get to a convergence that is arbitrarily. So we start with negative initially. This will, you can show that this theta of tau will go to 0 at a finite time, just out of this equation. You can iterate straightforwardly, and you will find the solution that is given by theta tau has to be.
What does theta not less than 0 physically mean?
So this is, you choose a t equal to 0, or tau equal to 0. Choose something that is beginning to converge. You're going to say that, you're going to be able to show by entering this equation that in a finite time, these things converge. Of course, that doesn't mean, and why is it that I'm bringing this up? So in a finite time, you're going to get a point where this congruence gets to kind of zero size. That, in and on its own, doesn't say anything yet. You could have chosen, again, just as in flat space-time.
Does that say that it goes to zero, or it just says that the rate of contraction is going to zero?
Well, what it's telling you is the rate of, you're going to be able to show out here, the rate of contraction.
It might just not go to, I don't know, it might not contract to a singular point or
no. No, you're actually going to find it's a singular, you're going to get a singularity out of this.
It doesn't tell us that necessarily.
Well, it will tell you.
If theta naught is less than zero, yes, theta tau is going to go to zero. Theta tau doesn't say.
So let me just, okay, let me go through the whole thing. Take this equation. You can iterate it in this way. So this will imply that dd tau, 1 over theta is greater or equal to 1/3. So I just pass this one, if you want, the other side, and then combine the theta. And out of this one, the solution tells us that theta to the minus 1 tau is greater or equal theta 0 to the minus 1 plus 1/3 tau. So what we find is, as you suppose you start with an initial tau, theta 0, at tau equal to 0, where this is negative. This is positive. The combination of the two will get to invariable point where this is 0. Right, which then is telling us that in the extreme regime that 1 over theta goes to 0, which then means that theta is going to infinity.
It
goes through minus infinity from below. So you start with negative, and then you can compute what is the rate of.
Zero.
Yeah, sorry, I said it wrong. Yeah, I said it wrong way. Yes, sorry about that. Yeah. So then that tells us that within a finite time, we have a singularity. The question now, and this is something we're going to occupy ourselves, is what does that mean? It might not mean anything, because we could have had that in flat space-time. So it might just mean that our congruence is having a singularity. So it's having a bad day. We got the wrong, if you wanted to do something with it, we got the wrong congruence. To say, if we're using this congruence to label our space-time, there is so far we can go, because then we choose back coordinates. However, And this we're only going to motivate maybe at the very end of the course. One can prove rigorous theorem under some further assumptions that we haven't discussed yet. And this will tell us that the singularity will be a true singularity. And the famous Hawking Penrose singularity theorems actually go from here. This is the equation they use. And then there are some conditions on this and some conditions on the space-time and the initial state that you choose. And you can prove that the singularity will be a true singularity.
Is it a true singularity? Because
as so here we haven't been able to say that. I mean,
a certain tau it goes to zero, but if you increase a tau, you get theta minus one is greater than a finite number.
Oh, but you already went through. Okay, so it's a singularity in that.
And then after that, you
have a caustic, right? So that sure, but once you got in here, suppose you would have used these coordinates to construct your solution. Here is where we would find a case where now I have a degenerate metric.
Yeah.
And then if we do the right work around here, we're going to be able to say, oh, there was nothing wrong with this. It was just a bad choice of coordinates. And this is where we're going to be discussing next week when we try to solve for Einstein, for the Schwarzschild black hole solution. As opposed to your regular physical theories, where you have a set of coordinates and then you're trying to find the fields that live on top of that, or a set of coordinates and a background space-time, say flat space-time, and you're solving equations there, you're constructing everything at once. You're constructing the metric and the coordinates as you solve the problem. So it's not a priori clear that your choice of coordinates are correct for the solution you're trying to obtain. And so this will be part of the things that we're going to have to discuss.
Looking at this, how can I know that this is just a matter of coordinate choice?
Great. Yes. So what?
I can't really figure out.
Right. You can't. And the example will be take flat space-time, construct a circle, and just imagine the rays that are going in that direction. You know these things are going to hit. But you also know this thing we're going to go through exactly this scenario. But you also know you can compute any curvature invariant, and they will all be zero. So that's the one we'll be telling you, oh, it was the wrong choice. And as I said, so with some more structure here, but starting from this equation, that's what the singularity theorems are that show
what is
that.
Exactly contracting here? I'm sorry.
As your, no, that's perfect. So initially, so first, this is just a big expansion or contraction. So we just call it the divergence, which would be positive or negative, that would be expansion or contraction, is given by this equation. So one case that we can choose is suppose you take initially slightly converging or non-converging at all. So this is negative, 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 and then this we argue it's negative. So
what is theta is divergence of u. What is u? What?
Oh, u was a tangent to our geodesics. So if you want, we can choose some geodesics that have tangent u.
So we're talking about a particle.
We're talking about, if you want a collection, this is your space-time, and you have a collection of particles that you're saying they are all geodesics. So this is the closest to what you were doing, if you want, in special relativity, where you say, I have a bunch of inertial frames. So my whole space-time is covered with inertial frames. So these are giving me my clocks and my rods.
So basically, if the particles that are going on the geodesics and they're contracting or expanding, because they're on the geodesic and there is no external force or whatever, so we're basically saying that our metric, our space-time is contracting or expanding?
Well, the curvature of our space-time will make them contract or expand. So here we're saying, so suppose you take, let's start with the simplest possible case.
So that singularity is basically saying our space-time is collapsing into a point?
Not necessarily. It's saying either that or either you have such a strong kind of curvature pool that you're about to hit some true singularity, or your initial choice of geodesics or curve that you chose need not be, well, that choice will lead to a scenario where they begin to cross. So you can take flat space time. I could choose these ones. This would be fine, but I could also choose these ones. So in this case, I would have that. So this equation says you're going to encounter that. That's a singularity.
Okay, so at this point, we don't know if it's...
You don't know whether it's a bad sign or not. I mean, you just know that your coordinates, your curves are crossing. If you use those curves to parameterize something, like, for instance, your coordinate, your time coordinate, you could have chosen your time coordinate along this this line. As you would do in special relativity, this thing is saying, OK, that was a bad choice.
Yeah.
Just as we could choose in special relativity, your frame of reference, my frame of reference, and we're running against each other, that would be a bad idea as well. We're going to get, whose clock is the right one? What we're going to be trying to do as we construct different examples is to construct the full space-time and then ask if we happen to see a problem, whether that problem was caused by a bad choice or by physics. And again, the context of where I wanted to make this, wanted to refer to this is that what I said, that Einstein equations are extremely complicated. It's very difficult to find reasonably physical solutions. One can find lots of solutions, but that are relevant, it's very delicate. And yet, people without having been able to find these general solutions, you can make general statements. Like, yes, the Big Bang is happening, it's a natural consequence of this theory. Or the space-time will have a cap here, and it comes out of that, without solving Einstein's equation, making that relation, and then a few extra assumptions that will tell you, oh, these geodesics are going to cross, but they're going to cross because your space-time is incomplete. There's something wrong there.
Where does the choice and congruence appear in the construction? Because all we've done is we only have one vector, which is the U. So
yes.
We only have one geodesic. I don't understand.
No. So we imagine that you had a family of geodesics. Otherwise, we couldn't. If you have only one geodesic, we cannot describe the expansions. So you have a family of geodesics, at least in some non-trivial neighborhood of your, say, a given one. So you can compute kind of the relative change of these geodesics and vectors as we carry them through. Right. So it's not just a single one.
But how can we use BAB, which is something that is constructed for just one geodesic?
It wasn't just one. We started with a family of geodesics, and out of that, that's what we're constructing.
So the only case in which we will not have the singularity is if all our vectors are parallel, so that we can define always a hypersurface that is
orthogonal to it, or that they started expanding. If they started expanding, then you just go and maybe you can cover. The only problem is that if you wanted to use, it depends what your goal with those geodesics is. If your goal with those geodesics is just try and understand whether gravity is attractive or not, then that's fine. You could say something. But if you wanted to use them for also labeling all your space-time points, and now you're choosing everything to, so if I think of the region here, and I choose this one going that way, this one going that way, well, what label do I give here? So then, but that's if you want to use them for constructing your space-time and labeling points along the way. So these are things that people that do numerical simulations, for instance, to construct solutions in highly non-trivial scenarios have to worry about how you choose those congruence over which you're going to describe physics.
And doing this, we are only able to find like singularities that are like defined in one point. But is it possible that we have something, that we have a region that is singular, but it's not zero-dimensional, but like a line?
You could do the same thing. You're going to have many geodesics that will end at a finite time. The question will then be, why did they end? Did they end because there was something wrong with your space-time, or was it just because they crossed? You have a sequence of them that will cross. And so then you could have a whole region where this is happening, because they are not all of them have to cross at the same time. Just two of them meeting already has a singular point associated to it.
But that gives you one point.
But then others will cross at a different point, and then the union of all those points will be what you're looking for.
Okay.
Yes.
Does our whole calculation here assume you have parallel geodesics at the start?
Parallel?
Like
or
you have a family of parallel geodesics.
I have a family of geodesics, yeah. I didn't use that word, but I had a family of geodesics, yeah.
But because it's similar to what Dawei's question is, because I thought that UA defines the initial direction of the family of the geodesics.
Yeah, so I have a bunch of curves.
They're all in the UA direction.
Yeah, but it's this. But this UA depends on the space that I'm at. So I imagine my spacetime is foliated, or it has a whole bunch of curves, arbitrary, an infinite number of curves. Associated to each curve, I have a vector U. So here, if you want to say U1 or U2, so I have as many as you want.
So it doesn't start with choosing a family of infinite parallel curves, just like infinitesimally, local curves will all be parallel.
Again, I don't. Why do you need the word parallel? I mean, I still haven't used anything. So the word parallel we use it, we're trying to measure this object, help us measure the failure of, say, orthogonal vectors to be parallel transported. But when I write this grad of U, right, I'm implicitly or effectively saying I'm comparing U's in the neighborhood, use with themselves, right? Because I'm computing how these vary. And this allows me, say, through this relation, say, because this, so that, this is where our B is, was the same as the equation that told us how we're going to be parallel transport other vectors that were kind of initially orthogonal to it.